Hello. Welcome to the Bore You to Sleep podcast. The podcast that will hopefully help you get to sleep. I am going to read an open source book, one that is not particularly interesting, but one that is hopefully boring enough to get you to sleep. Tonight's readings will come from The Green Mirror, A Quiet Story, written by Hugh Walpole and published in 1917. The book looks at the world from the viewpoint of a young man who spends most of his time alone, reading books and exploring his imagination. My name is Teddy, and I aim to help people everywhere get a good night's rest. I want to help people doze off so they can have a productive day and achieve whatever it is they set out to do. I read a different story every episode to help you get a good night's rest. It is designed to play in the background as you slowly fall asleep. Every episode tells a different story, and you're welcome to listen to whichever one works for you. Special thank you to Nat Byrne and Ray for your messages through the website. Special thanks also to Bruna Poe and Emily Hetch for your reviews on iTunes. It is extremely rewarding to know that I'm helping you get a good night's rest in order for you to have a productive day. Before you doze off, and if you would be so kind, please take a quick moment to leave a review and rating in iTunes or your podcast player of choice. You would be surprised at how helpful this is. It really does help me reach more people who need a good night's rest. You're always welcome to say hello or support the podcast at boreyoutosleep.com. In the meantime, lie back, relax, and enjoy the readings. The Green Mirror, A Quiet Story. Chapter 1. The Ceremony. The fog had swallowed up the house, and the house had submitted. So thick was the fog that the towers of Westminster Abbey, the river, and the fat complacency of the church in the middle of the square, even the three plain trees in front of the old gate, and the heavy old-fashioned porch had all vanished together, leaving in their place the rattle of a cab, the barking of a dog, isolated sounds that ascended plaintively from a lost, a submerged world. The house had indeed, in its time, seen many fogs, for it had known its first one in the days of Queen Anne, and even then it had yielded, without surprise and without curiosity, to its tyranny. On the brightest of days, this was a solemn, unenterprising, unimaginative building, standing four square to all the winds, its windows planted solidly, securely, its vigorous propriety well suited to its safe, unagitated surroundings. Its faded red brick had weathered many London storms, and would weather many more. That old, quiet square, with its uneven stones, its church, and its plain trees, had the abbey, the Houses of Parliament, the river for its guardians. The skies might fall, the Thames burst into a flaming fire, Rundle Square would not stir from its tranquility. The old house, number 5, Rundle Square, had for its most charming feature its entrance. First came an old iron gate guarded on either side by weather-beaten stone pillars. Then a cobbled path, with little green lawns to the right and left of it, ran to the door, whose stolidity was crowned with an old porch of dim red brick. This was unusual enough for London, but there the gate, the little garden, the porch had stood for some hundreds of years, and that progress that had already its throttling fingers about London's neck had as yet left Rundle Square to its staid property. Westminster abides like a little cathedral town at the heart of London. One is led to it through Whitehall, through Victoria Street, through Belgravia, over Westminster Bridge with preparatory caution. The thunder of London sinks as the traveller approaches, dying gradually as though the spirit of the town warned you, with his finger at his lip. To the roar of the traffic there succeeds the solemn striking of Big Ben, the chiming of the Abbey bells. So narrow and winding are many of the little streets that such traffic as penetrates through them proceeds slowly, cautiously, almost sleepily. There are old buildings and grass squares, many clergymen, schoolboys in black gowns and battered top hats, and at the corners one may see policemen motionless, solemn, stationed, one supposes, to threaten disturbance or agitation. There is, it seems, no impulse here to pile many more events upon the lap of the day than the poor thing can decently hold. Behind the windows of Westminster life is passing, surely, with easy tranquility, the very doorbells are, many of them, old and uncomfortable, unsuited to any frantic ringing. There does not sound, through every hour, the whirring clang of workmen flinging, with eager haste, into the reluctant air, hideous and contemptuous buildings. Dust does not rise in blinding clouds from the tortured corpses of old and happy houses. Those who live here live long. Number 5, Rundle Square, then, had its destiny in pleasant places. Upon a fine summer evening, the old red brick with its windows staring complacently upon a comfortable world showed a fine colour. Its very chimneys were square and solid, its eaves and water pipes regular and mathematical. Whatever horrid catastrophe might convulse the rest of London, Number 5 would suffer no hurt. The god of propriety, the strongest of all the gods, had it beneath his care. Now behind the fog it waited, as it had waited so often before, with certain assurances for its release. Inside the house at about 4:30, upon this afternoon, November 8th in the year 1902, young Henry Trenchard was sitting alone. He was straining his eyes over a book that had interested him so deeply that he could not leave it in order to switch on the electric light. His long nose stuck into the book's very heart, and his eyelashes almost brushed the paper. The drawing room where he was had caught some of the fog and kept it, and Henry Trenchard's only light was the fading glow of a red, cavernous fire. Henry Trenchard, now 19 years of age, had known, in all those 19 years, no change in that old drawing room. As an ugly and tiresome baby, he had wailed before the somber indifference of that old, stiff green wallpaper. A little brighter then, perhaps, had sprawled upon the same old green carpet, had begged to be allowed to play with the same collection of little scent bottles and stones and rings and miniatures that lay now in the same decent symmetry, in the same narrow glass-topped table over by the window. It was by shape and design as a heavy room, slipping into its true spirit with the London dusk, the London fog, and the London lamp-lit winter afternoon, seeming awkward, stiff, almost affronted, before the sunshine and summer weather. One or two Trenchards, two soldiers and a bishop, were there in heavy old gold frames, two ponderous glass-fronted bookcases, guarded from any frivolous touch high stiff-backed volumes of Gibbons and Richardson and Hooker. There were some old watercolours of faded green lawns, dim rocks and seas with neglected boats upon the sand, all these painted in the stiff precision of the 30s and the 40s, smoked and fogged a little in their thin black frames. Upon one round table, indeed, there was a concession to the modern spirit in the latest numbers of the Cornhill and Blackwood magazines, the Quarterly Review and the Hibbert Journal. The chairs in the room were for the most part stiff with gilt backs, and wore a don't you dare sit down upon me eye, but two armchairs near the fire, of old green leather, were comfortable enough, and upon one of these Henry was now sitting. Above the wide stone fireplace was a large old gold mirror, a mirror that took into its expanse the whole of the room, so that standing before it, with your back to the door, you could see everything that happened behind you. The mirror was old, and gave to the view that it embraced some old comfortable touch, so that everything within it was soft and still at rest. Now, in the gloom and shadow, the reflection was green and dark, with the only point of colour, the fading fire. Before it a massive gold clock with the figures of the three graces, stiff and angular, at its summit ticked away as though it were the voice of a very old gentleman telling an interminable story. It served indeed for the voice of the mirror itself. Henry was reading a novel that showed upon its back Moody's bright yellow label. He was reading, as the clock struck 4:30, these words: I sat on the stump of a tree at his feet, and below us stretched the land, the great expanse of the forests, somber under the sunshine, rolling like a sea, with glints of winding rivers, the grey spots of villages, and here and there a clearing, like an islet of light amongst the dark waves of continuous treetops. A brooding gloom lay over this vast and monotonous landscape. The light fell on it as if into an abyss. The land devoured the sunshine. Only far off along the coast, the empty ocean, smooth and polished within the faint bays, seemed to rise up to the sky in a wall of steel. And there I was with him, high on the sunshine on top of that historic hill. The striking of the clock brought him away from the book with a jerk. So deep had he been sunk in that he looked now about the dusky room with a startled, uncertain gaze. The familiar place settled once more about him, and with a little sigh, he sank back into his chair. His thin, bony legs stuck out in front of him. One trouser leg was hitched up and his sock, falling down over his boot, left bare part of his calf. His boots had not been laced tightly, and the tongues had slipped aside, showing his sock. He was a long, thin youth, his hair untidy, his black tie up at the back of his collar. One white and rather ragged cuff had slipped down over his wrist. The other was invisible. His eyes were grey and weak. He had a long pointed nose with two freckles on the very end of it. But his mouth was kindly, although too large and indeterminate. His cheeks were thin and showed high cheekbones. His chin was pronounced enough to be strong, but nevertheless helped him very little. He was tidy and ungainly, but not entirely unattractive. His growth was at the stage when nature has not made up its mind as to the next, the final move. That may, after all, be something very pleasant. His eyes now were dreamy and soft because he was thinking of the book. No book, perhaps, in all his life before, had moved him so deeply, and he was very often moved, but as a rule, by cheap and sentimental emotions. He knew that he was cheap. He knew that he was sentimental. He very often hated and despised himself. He could see the forests rolling like a sea. It was as though he himself had been perched upon that high, bright hill, and he was exalted. He felt with the same exaltation the space and the freedom, the liberty, the picture of a world wherein anything might happen, where heroes, fugitives, scoundrels, cowards, conquerors all alike might win their salvation. Room for everyone, no one to pull one up, no one to make one ashamed of what one says and does, no crowd watching one's every movement, adventures for the wishing and courage to meet them. He looked about the room and hated it. The old shabby hemmed-in thing. He hated this life to which he was condemned. He hated himself, his world, his uninspiring future. My God, I must do something. I will do something. But suppose I can't. His head fell again. Suppose he were out in that other world, there in the heart of those dark forests. Suppose that he found that he did no better there than here. That would be indeed the most terrible thing of all. He gazed up into the mirror, saw in it the reflection of the room, the green walls, the green carpet, the old faded green place like moss covering dead ground, soft, damp, dark, and beyond outside the mirror, the world of the forests, the great expanse of forests and beyond the ocean, smooth and polished, rising up to the sky in a wall of steel. His people, his family, his many, many relations, his world, he thought, were all inside the mirror, all embedded in that green, soft, silent enclosure. He saw stretching from one end of England to the other, in all provincial towns, in neat little houses, with neat little gardens, in cathedral cities with their sequestered closes, in villages with the deep green lanes leading up to the rectory gates, in old country houses hemmed in by wide stretching fields, in little lost places by the sea, all these persons happily, peacefully sunk up to their very necks in the green moss. Within the mirror this, outside the mirror, the rolling forests, guarded by the shining wall of sea. His own family passed before him, his grandfather, his great aunt Sarah, his mother and his father, Aunt Aggie and Aunt Betty, Uncle Tim, Millicent, Catherine. He paused then. The book slipped away and fell onto the floor. Catherine, dear Catherine, he did not care what she was. And then, swept by a fresh wave of feeling springing up, stretching his arms, facing the room, he did not care what any of them were. He was the idiot, the discontented, ungrateful idiot. He loved them all. He wouldn't change one of them. He wouldn't be in any other family in all the world. The door opened. In came old Rocket, the staff and prop of the family, to turn up the lights and to poke the fire. In a minute, tea would come. "Why, Mr. Henry, no fire nor lights," he shuffled to the windows, pulling the great heavy curtains across them. His knees were cracking very slowly as he bent, picked up the book and laid it carefully on the table next to the Hibbert journal. "I hope you've not been reading, Mr. Henry, in this bad light," he said. Later, between 9 and 9:30, Henry was sitting with his father and his uncle, smoking and drinking after dinner. Tonight was an evening of ceremony, the family ceremony of the year. Therefore, although the meal had been an extremely festive one with many flowers, the perfect mountain of fruit in the huge silver bowl in the center of the table, and the most sacred of all ports, produced on this occasion and Christmas Day, nevertheless only the family had been present. No distant relations, even certainly no friends. This was Grandfather Trenchard's birthday. The ladies vanished. There remained only Henry, his father and Uncle Tim. Henry was sitting there, very self-conscious over his glass of port. He was always very self-conscious when Uncle Tim was present. Uncle Tim was a fawner and was large-limbed and absent-minded like Henry's father. Uncle Tim had a wild head of grey hair, a badly kept grey beard, and clothed his long, loose figure in long, loose garments. He was here today and gone tomorrow, preferred the country to the town and had a little house down in Gloucestershire, where he led an untidy bachelor existence whose motive impulses were birds and flowers. Henry was very fond of Uncle Tim. He liked his untidiness, his careless geniality, his freedom, and his happiness. Henry's father, George Trenchard, was splendid, that thought Henry, was the only possible word, and the boy, surveying other persons' fathers, wondered why Catherine Millicent and himself should have been chosen out of all the world to be so favoured. George Trenchard, at this time about 60 years of age, was over 6 feet in height and broad in proportion. He was growing too stout. His hair was grey and the top of his head bald. His eyes were brown and absent-minded. His mouth large with a lurking humour in its curves. His cheeks were fat and round, and there was the beginning of a double chin. He walked always in a rambling, rolling kind of way, like a sea captain on shore, still balancing himself to the swing of his vessel, his hands deep sunk into his trouser pockets. Henry had been privileged sometimes to see him, when absorbed in the evolution of an essay or the chapter of some book. He is, of course, one of our foremost authorities on the early 19th century period of English literature, especially Hazlitt and De Quincey. He rolled up and down his study, with his head back, his hands sunk in his pockets, whistling a little tune. Very wonderful he seemed to Henry then. He was the most completely careless of optimists, refusing to be brought down to any stern fact whatever, hated any strong emotion or stringent relations with anyone, treated his wife and children as the most delightful accidents against whom he had most happily tumbled. His kindness of heart was equally only by the lightning speed with which he forgot the benefits that he had conferred, and the persons upon whom he had conferred them. Like a happy bird, he went caroling through life. Alone, of all living beings, his daughter Catherine had bound him to her with cords. For the rest, he loved and forgot them all. Now, on this family occasion of his father's birthday, his father was 87 today, he was absolutely happy. He was proud of his family when any definite occasion, such as this, compelled him to think of it. He considered that it had all been a very jolly, pleasant dinner, that there would certainly follow a very jolly, pleasant evening. He liked especially to have his brother, Timothy, with him. He loved them all, blessed their hearts, he felt, as he assured them, not a day more than 20. And that concludes tonight's readings. I hope you're feeling a little drowsy. I look forward to bringing you another episode very soon. In the meantime, good night.